Thank you very much, Elder Bogus. I truly appreciate the invitation to join you here this week. And it's my desire to share some of the experience that the Lord has given me over the course of my life and my career. I started working in agriculture with my first garden when I was about 8 years old in Northern California. And through the providence of the Lord, I had developed into an agriculture career as a crop consultant, pest control advisor for large-scale commercial agriculture in Northern California primarily. Eventually, that experience extended into the Salinas and Pajaro Valleys of California, the Salad Bowl of America, if you will, the Imperial Valley, and eventually into areas in Latin America, into Mexico, Guatemala, and Ecuador. Over the course of my career, I've seen many different examples of how to grow crops. And for the most part, my experience early on in my career was just that, growing conventional crops using conventional methods of pesticides, fertilizers, and trying to get the most production from an acre of land. I share that with you because over the course of this afternoon and the next couple of days, I'm going to be sharing some information with you that you might not be aware of. I think all of us are somewhat attuned to the fact that food today isn't what it used to be. And I'm so thankful to be here in rural West Virginia with people that still practice the art and the science of gardening. The skill of gardening is still very much alive here. And not just as a token gesture either. Most of us here actually make as much use of our gardens as we can, and I'm very thankful for that. In the year 2000, I was baptized into the Seventh-day Adventist Church. At that point in time, I realized that working for the world was no longer an option for me. I wanted to devote my life to serving the Lord. I went into ministry. Over the past 10 years or so, I have been doing agriculture education. And 2 years ago, we were fortunate enough to find a farm over in Calhoun County. We purchased about 120-acre farm with the objective of starting a small-scale market farm. Now, for me, this was quite a shift in paradigm because in my previous life as an agricultural consultant, I was working with tens of thousands of acres, and it was not unusual during the course of a growing season for me to have had an impact on what was growing on as many as 60 or 70,000 acres. Right now, I'm farming about 3 acres, and we're using organic methods. We're a certified organic farm through the Certified Naturally Grown program, not the USDA program, and our desire is to bring fresh fruits and vegetables to the local community as an outreach. We see agriculture as an avenue of evangelism that is a very powerful avenue of evangelism today. And I also recognized coming into the church late in life and basically studying my way into the church that this church has a very powerful health message. Unfortunately, that health message has been somewhat separated from agriculture over the course of time. In studying our Adventist history, I recognize that agriculture once held a tremendous prominence in our educational programs, and I understand why that has shifted because of economics and all the forces at play that have separated man from the soil and in many other ways too, but I still recognize that our health first and foremost begins in the soil. It doesn't start at the grocery store by making the right selections of foods. It starts with the soil. I recognize, too, in my study of the spirit of prophecy, that agriculture plays a key role not only in our health, but in the development of our character. And it's important for us as Seventh-day Adventists, if we are to have our feet well spiritually grounded, that we have contact with our Creator through the garden. Man's first trial on this planet took place in the garden. And I believe that as we face challenges at the end of time here, the garden again is going to be a trial ground for us. So with that in mind, I want to share some things with you today to encourage you, to try to motivate you a little bit more about making right choices about the foods that you do eat, and first and foremost, to try to encourage you to take steps in developing your own gardens and to take responsibility for growing some of your own food. Now, we have a website. I didn't bring a lot of literature with me this week, but there are all kinds of resources on my website. So for those of you that are curious about where to find more information, the web address up there, bereagardens.org, will give you a lot of information about the training programs that we have. Once a month, we want to run a one-week training program. We've had people from as far away as Idaho, Florida, and Maine come through our programs over the course of this past year. And we also have a wealth of information on that website as far as gardening resources for you. Many of the things that I'll be talking about this week in the way of materials and supplies and how-to stuff is listed on that website too. So make a note of that if you would. The Lord gave us two books to study, didn't he? He gave us his holy word, and he also gave us the book of nature. And part of what I want to emphasize over the course of my talks for the next few days here with you is to help us understand that we cannot study one of these books in and of itself and have a proper education. The prophet of the Lord wrote, "The natural and the spiritual are to be combined in the studies of our schools. The operations of agriculture illustrate the Bible lessons. The laws obeyed by the earth reveal the fact that it is under the masterly power of an infinite God. The same principles run through the spiritual and the natural world. Divorce God and his wisdom from the acquisition of knowledge, and you have a lame, one-sided education, dead to all the saving qualities which give power to man, so that he is, what? Incapable of acquiring immortality through faith in Christ." Now, I'm going to maintain that if we do not study the book of nature, if we're not participating in the Lord's creation and experiencing firsthand his still small voice in guiding us in the garden, that we still will have a lame, one-sided education, even if we are very proficient and very knowledgeable in our study of the scriptures. I think it takes both to have the kind of balance that is going to be necessary for us to accomplish the work that needs to be done so that Jesus can return to claim us. We have a world of ministry to accomplish. We have a world that is languishing right now, in part due to physical needs. We recognize through our health work the vast field of opportunity that we have, and this field extends to us as well in our gardens. Over 100 years ago, the prophet of the Lord wrote, "So long as God gives me power to speak to our people, I shall continue to call upon parents to leave the cities and get homes in the country where they can cultivate the soil and learn from the book of nature the lessons of purity and simplicity. The things of nature are the Lord's silent ministers given to us to teach us spiritual truths. They speak to us of the love of God and declare the wisdom of the great master artist." Now, these are just a couple of quotations that I'm sharing with you this morning. If you search through the Spirit of Prophecy, I'm sure that many of you have found many, many other explanations and encouragements to participate in agriculture and to make an agriculture an aspect of our growth and development for our character as well as for our personal security and for our health. Now, America understood this when it was first founded as a nation. This country was founded as an agrarian society, and many of our founding fathers were very heavily involved in agriculture. Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1785 that cultivators of the earth are the most valuable citizens. They are the most vigorous, the most independent, the most virtuous, and they are tied to their country and wedded to its liberty and interests by the most lasting bands. That just makes sense, doesn't it? If we have a big investment of our time, effort, energy, and resources in our land and in our gardens, we're going to have a little bit more concern and care about what is going on around us that has an impact on that huge investment that we have. In 1787, he wrote to his friend James Madison, also an ardent agriculturalist. I think our governments will remain virtuous for many centuries as long as they are chiefly agricultural. Now, we've seen some pretty serious shifts in the agricultural population of this country since those things were written, and I want to point a couple of things out to you that have a huge impact on what you and I have available to us today for feeding ourselves. In 1790, these statistics are from the United States Department of Agriculture. In 1790, shortly after Mr. Jefferson wrote those comments, 90% of the labor force was engaged in agriculture. Now, this doesn't mean that 90% of the people were farmers. This includes everyone that was involved in agricultural production up to the point of retail sales. So this included people that were transporting the products to market, the millers, all the people that were processing agricultural commodities, as well as the farmers and farm laborers. You can see how over time this number has dwindled until the last figures that we have from the USDA are for 2005, less than 1% of all Americans are engaged in any way with food production. To contrast that, we can look at the number of Walmart workers in this country and realize that right now there are more people employed by Walmart than there are involved in producing your food. Now, what does that imply? What does that tell us? What does that mean to us? Most of us look at this statistic and we say, wow, how efficient. We've got a remarkably technologically advanced system of food production here, and it takes so little human effort now to produce our food that this is a wonderful thing. We can all go off and do all kinds of other things. But the reality is that the power over that food system is concentrated in the hands of those that make up that 1%. Indeed, it's concentrated in the hands of even fewer than that 1%, because there are a handful, of very large multinational corporations that are making most of the decisions today about what you and I eat. And we have relinquished control over our food supply to a profit motive. This has had some very serious consequences. Historically in this country, when we were founded, the typical farm was one man, one horse, one plow, one day, and 1 acre. That's what a man could plow in 1 day. That's where an acre came from. Farms were very self-sufficient and autonomous. The farmer had everything he needed to provide for himself and conduct his activity in his business right there on his farm. They saved their seeds from year to year. They had diversified farms so that they were not growing one single crop that would deplete the soils. They practiced crop rotation. They used animals as a portion of their agricultural program, so they had inputs of manures. And the farms were very diversified. Slowly, over time, this changed. Farm scale started to increase, the number of acres started to increase, and crops became more specialized as world markets developed. Transportation facilities were developed, primarily the rail system in this country, that dramatically changed the way that our agricultural land was used, so that we were now capable of transporting foods over long distances. Overseas markets expanded, and farm workers were hired from migrant populations, as many of those that were historically engaged in farm work moved off to serve in the Industrial Revolution and moved into urban environments. Shortly after the turn of the last century, farming became mechanized. Lots of equipment and machinery was developed that again enhanced the productivity on a per acre basis. Populations begin to move into areas to accommodate that industry and to find jobs and the promise of greater income. Off-farm inputs of seed and fertilizer began shortly after the turn of the last century, indeed around the time of World War I. Rail transportation and storage facilities grew, and for the first time, bank financing of farm businesses began to take place. Farmers would approach their local banks, they would borrow the amount of money necessary to produce their crops for that year, and then at the end of the growing season, they would service that debt. And the financial industries got involved in agriculture too. World War I had a pretty profound effect on agriculture in America. Number one, a lot of people were removed from farms to industry to serve in the war effort. We had a lot of technology improvements that were essentially intended to make mechanized warfare more efficient, and much of that technology was then applied to agriculture at the end of the war. We had commercialization of fertilizers as a direct result of World War I. The munitions industry that had been manufacturing the bombs and the explosives for the war effort were using many of the same compounds that are plant nutrients: sulfur, potassium nitrate, nitrogen-based fertilizers. All of these things grew out of the explosives industry because the chemistry is very much the same, and plants that had been manufacturing explosives for the war effort now converted to manufacturing primarily nitrogen-based fertilizers. We also had the hybridization of seed that became popular shortly after World War I. Now, hybridized seed bore the promise of producing more product per acre, and farmers were intrigued with that and encouraged to buy seed rather than retain their own for the advantage of that additional yield. The unfortunate aspect of buying hybridized seed is it made you dependent on a seed company because you cannot save that seed and grow it successfully the following year. We'll explain a little bit more about seed specifically later this week, but it made farmers essentially dependent on resources outside of the farm. The Dust Bowl of the 1930s also had a huge impact on agriculture and the way we conduct agriculture today in America. The Dust Bowl pointed out that there were some strategies that were at play in terms of the way that we went about farming, dragging heavy pieces of steel through the ground and tearing up the prairie sod and exposing it to drought and windy conditions that might not be such a good way to farm. So directly out of the Dust Bowl, we had an impetus by the United States Department of Agriculture to develop strategies for no-till agriculture. And in fact, today, dominantly all of the commodity crops that are grown in this country are grown in a method utilizing no-till agriculture, where the ground is never worked. It's simply sprayed with herbicides or other chemical treatments to control the weeds. And this, in part, has led directly to the new technology that's being employed in agriculture, and that's the genetic engineering of our food. World War II also had an effect on the agriculture industry here in the United States. We had further industrialization. We had, because of efforts during the war to develop toxic compounds for warfare purposes and for extermination of people, new technologies of developing pesticides. Pesticides grew directly out of part of the German war effort. We also had more urban migration, and we had a tremendous shift in this country socially as women, for the first time, entered the workforce. And many of them that entered the workforce to serve in that movement, in that war movement, never came back. And this, for us, as Seventh-day Adventist Christians, has some pretty profound implications because we recognize, number one, that our first school for our children is where? In the home. If the mother's not in the home, then those children are being educated outside of the home. And the education aspects of how families developed and grew changed dramatically after World War II, in part because of this. Now, there's a statement in the Spirit of Prophecy that says agriculture should be the A, B, and C of the education in our schools. Where's that first school? In the home, right? Not just our institutions, but in our home. So if mom's not at home and dad's not at home, who's teaching the A, B, and C of education? And at this point in time, with the increased industrialization of agriculture, we saw many, many more people being separated from the soil. And much of our agricultural heritage has disappeared since World War II. During World War II, there were a lot of victory gardens in this country, and a lot of people were engaged in producing their food. After that, as the industrialization of agriculture began to occur, more and more people were separated from the land, and fewer of us now have the skills necessary to grow food. In fact, in most audiences that I speak to, when I ask how many people are raising a garden, I get fewer than 10% of the hands raised. I praise the Lord for being here in West Virginia, and I came here 2 years ago, but I consider myself a West Virginian now because this year I planted my first row of half-runner beans. So that must make me a West Virginian. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, another revolution took place in agriculture, and this was called the Green Revolution. It was led by this man here, Dr. Norman Borlaug. Dr. Borlaug was a plant breeder who emphasized developing plants through hybridization that would accommodate industrial processes of growing crops. He developed plants that were shorter in stature, for example, and easier to harvest with mechanical harvesters. He developed crops that were very productive, but also very susceptible to disease and insects. But he wasn't particularly concerned about that because we had lots of sprays that were relatively cheap for dealing with those diseases and insects. So his whole package of agriculture basically was based on an industrial-wide model of not only the seed, but the equipment to go with the seed and the chemistries and the fertilizers and the pesticides to go with that seed to achieve these results of a greater yield. Now, another consequence of his plant breeding efforts were that he developed plants that primarily used the process of photosynthesis to produce starch. That's what photosynthesis does in a plant, is it creates starches. Now, today we know that there are a whole array of nutrients that we need from plants separate and apart from just the calories that we get from starch. We need proteins, we need vitamins, we need a whole array of phytochemicals that we're only now beginning to understand a little bit. Now, his direction of his plant breeding did not consider any of this. And because so many growers embraced this technology in order to realize greater profits from the higher yields, the genetic diversity of our major crops, rice, corn, soy, dry beans, wheat, diminished dramatically during this period of time. And that shallowing of the gene pool, if you will, has increased even more rapidly in recent years. But the net consequence of this development of the Green Revolution is that the nutritional value of the foods that we eat today has plummeted from where it was just a generation or two ago. In fact, some studies have indicated that crops grown on the same land, same variety of crops, same growing techniques have diminished more than 50% in their nutritional quality in just the last 30 years. Part of this is due to the fact that the soils themselves are also being depleted because growers today are concerned with the bottom line and they are concerned about the costs of inputs that go into developing their crops. A few fertilizer elements are added to those soils, but one of the things that we're going to learn later this week is that plants don't use as many nutrients as we do. So it's a lot easier to grow a healthy-looking plant on soil that's pretty depleted when it comes to having the nutrition that you and I need. One of my favorite authors is a man named Wendell Berry. He lives over in Kentucky. He's a Christian author. And he wrote a book back in the 1970s that I read called The Unsettling of America, Culture and Agriculture. And this is a very interesting read because it points to how Satan has been so very successful in separating us from our role with the soil and with the garden. Now, I want to ask you a question. When God created man, where did he put him? He put him in a garden, and what was his instruction to man? To dress it and to keep it, correct? Now, I've got a question for you. Why did a perfect garden need a gardener? Wasn't that garden perfect? Didn't have weeds, didn't have problems. But he instructed Adam to daily give attention to that garden. Not because the garden needed it, but because Adam needed it. Adam needed the garden for the opportunity to see God's character evidenced through his creation. We still need that today. You and I still need that today. And Satan knows that. And he's done his best to separate us from that opportunity to have that direct contact with your Creator in the garden. Wendell Berry points this out, and he also points out some of the important developments that have occurred in the growth of how we retail food in this country and how that has impacted agriculture. Retail supermarkets today basically contain an array of products from around the world. You can buy virtually any product you want, any time you want. There are no longer seasons in our supermarkets. I remember growing up as a youngster, I grew up in Northern California, we were still excited when grapes were in season because it was a pretty short window of time. From about late June until the first part of September, we had grapes. The rest of the year, we didn't see grapes. When strawberry season was in, we had strawberries. The rest of the year, we didn't. But now you can go into that supermarket at any time and find these products shipped from halfway around the globe, grown under a variety of different chemically intensive processes that give us something that looks like a strawberry or looks like a tomato or looks like a grape, but it doesn't really have the nutritional value or the taste or the health-giving properties of those foods that we need to really do our ministry, our health ministry, properly. So our agrarian society began to disappear. And right now what we have are massive corporate farms. Even family-owned farms today are very large if they're successful. The average farm in America today is over 1,500 acres. The break-even point for most grain farmers is about 2,000 acres. If you're growing less than 2,000 acres of grain, you're in a losing battle. We've had erosion of farmland, environmental pollution from some of the strategies that we've employed. The no-till movement has taken prominence in this country, which has led to an even greater number of chemical applications to the soil, which affect not only the crops that are grown, but the environment and our water as well. And the long-term result of all of this has been that farmers' income is actually lower today than it was in the 1970s. Now, how do we still have farmers that are in business? It's because you and I are subsidizing those farmers. Most farmers today are producing crops, particularly commodity crops, at below the cost of production. And although you and I may appreciate it when we walk into the local retail grocery store and pay our grocery bill and buy a big shopping cart full of groceries for a relatively small price, we don't realize that we're also paying that for that food a second time when we pay our income tax, because a lot of our tax dollars are going to support these farmers. A little later on, I'm going to talk about organic food, and I'm going to encourage you folks to buy local and organic food. And one of the first complaints I get when I say that is, oh, it's so expensive. My response to that is, you're cracked, because the reality is that we pay less for food today than any society in the history of mankind has paid. Less of our time, effort, and money goes to providing the food that we need than at any other time in man's history. And when you consider the health consequences of eating the standard American diet, folks, even a standard American diet rich in plant proteins and fresh vegetables and fresh fruits, you're still going to be struggling to have a totally healthful lifestyle. And the consequence of eating inexpensive food today is going to be more than made up for with the expense of healthcare later on. This is a picture of an orchard across the street from where I grew up in Northern California, and it just kind of points to the fact that agriculture today is a very technologically advanced and highly complex system of things. You'll notice the drip tube along the base of those trees. You'll notice that all those trees are very uniform. You'll notice that there's a buffer sprayed under those trees where no weeds are growing and that there's some grass growing out in the center of that row. These things are all calculated for a purpose. And there are lots of costs associated with developing an orchard like this. The development cost for an almond orchard in California today is about $50,000 an acre. And much of that has to do with the technology. employed in the irrigation systems and the chemical management of the orchards, the trees themselves, the ground preparation, and so forth. Rice fields in Northern California. A small farm there is about 2,500 acres. Most of the work done on rice these days is done by aircraft. We have very little contact with the soil. The harvesters running through the field at the end of the season is about the only time that any track equipment is actually on the ground in a rice field today. And it's very chemically intensive again. Now, because of all this specialization in agriculture, we've also globalized agriculture. We've identified parts of the world where it's cheapest to produce a certain crop, and that's where we focused on producing those crops. So today, most of our produce travels an average of 1,670 miles before it even gets to our plate. Now, this has some implications far and above the fact that, wow, that's just a long way to ship a head of lettuce, or a head of broccoli, or an apple. The implications are that in order for food to sustain a journey like that, and by the way, much of the time this journey takes anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks. Most of the food that you're buying, even though it may look fresh on the grocer's produce case, is 3 to 6 weeks old, sometimes even much older than that. But that age is disguised because that produce has been bred, number one, to sustain that kind of treatment. It's been harvested at a very immature point before all those important phytochemicals that are part of our nutrition are developed. And it's been treated post-harvest, that means after the stuff is cut, with pesticides to prevent rot and spoilage in the process of transporting it to you. The net result of all this, the net consequence of all this, is that the nutritional value of food today is lousy. It's very, very poor compared to what you can harvest out of your own gardens that is fully ripe, that doesn't have those chemical treatments, and that has been allowed to grow the way that the Lord intended those crops to be grown in the first place. Another important fact for you folks, I know when I give some of these talks, a lot of people are thinking end time issues, and they want to know more about agriculture so they can prepare for a time of no buy and no sell, so they can prepare for a time of difficulty and challenge. Well, I'm going to tell you that time is here right now, folks. In 2005, America actually became a net food importer. That means we import more food than we export now. And dominantly, what we produce and export here are cheap grains. Corn, much of which is being diverted now to ethanol production, and soy. But our fruits, our vegetables, our high-value crops, those things that we, particularly those of us that are vegetarian or even vegan vegetarians, consume, are dominantly being grown overseas. More than 60% of all the apples in this country for sale today are coming from China. America, the home of apple pie, is buying most of her apples from China. With things like garlic, it's over 80%. Now, most of us are aware that a lot of things are coming in over the border from Latin America. That's been a trend that's been occurring over a long period of time, but we're importing things from as far away as South Africa now. This is troubling to me. Number one health problem in our country is obesity. And I'm sure that with the presentations Dr. John Clark will be giving you later this week, he'll be sharing with you some aspects about how to deal with this too. But I think all of us as Americans recognize that obesity is a big problem. Now, is it a big problem in America simply because we're a gluttonous nation that's eating a lot of fast food, that's susceptible to all the advertising that's around us, and we're drinking too much soda? That may well be part of the answer. But I'm going to postulate something today for you to think about a little bit that I think is part of the reason why obesity is such a problem in this country too. And that is that the food that we're growing in this country today is so depleted of nutrition that our bodies are in a constant state of craving. Now, I grew up in an agricultural area. I've eaten fresh produce and fresh vegetables for a large part of my life. And I remember going through growth spurts when I was in my teen years where I would get cravings for spinach, specifically. If I didn't get my spinach fix, if I wasn't able to eat spinach, my appetite just raged, and I would eat everything and anything that came across in front of me until I had that spinach. And once I had that spinach, that craving was satisfied, whether I needed the vitamin A or the iron. I don't know what it was in the spinach. I just knew that I wanted something green and leafy. Now, over time, because our bodies are in a constant state of craving, we don't have those nutrients in our foods anymore. Our appetites are constantly stimulated because our bodies are constantly in a search for the nutrition that we need. And I believe that this is Satan's way of disguising a famine in America today, where we have people that are literally starving to death in 300-pound bodies. This is kind of a picture I throw in here to emphasize that point. When I worked in Northern California, these are some of the fields that I worked with in my consulting work. Almonds, we grew a lot of sunflower seed crops in Northern California because of the predictable climate. These were not to be consumed. These were sunflowers that were actually going to be planted later up in the Dakotas for oil seeds. And vineyards, rice fields, spinach fields, that's a tomato field under sprinklers in the upper left there. And I worked for a period of time in horticulture too, and that's actually a field of roses down there on the lower right. The reason I wanted to show this to you is that if you look closely at these pictures, to many people, these are pictures that are really pretty beautiful. They speak to our success in our conquering of nature in some ways. As we look at these fields, we don't see any weeds out there. These are massive fields. The amount of food that's being grown there is enormous. But I can pretty much guarantee that if you walk those fields, you're going to notice that a lot of things are missing from the environment. Things like birds, things like insects, other weeds, other species of life. And this is all based on the chemical treatments that we use in agriculture today to produce our food. I've come to look at nature entirely differently after being a part of the process of essentially sterilizing the landscape for so many years. And I've come to realize that those are very destructive methods that produce stuff that looks like food but is not really food. It doesn't really serve the purpose of nourishing us. And as we look at this problem, it's a bigger problem than simply profit motives or the greed of corporations can explain. I want us, as we talk about agriculture this week, to look at it through the lens of the great controversy. Because really, folks, that's what we're dealing with here. And with that in mind, as we study the Lord's Word and as we study the book of nature, let's keep this scripture in mind, because as I proceed this week and I start to criticize and compare and share information with you about some of what the agribusiness industry is doing, it's not because I think they're the bad guys. I know who the bad guy is. Are they influenced by the bad guy? Yes. No question about that. But that doesn't mean that we point our finger to the farmer or to the corporation and or to the government or to the agencies that control agriculture as the enemy in this situation. The enemy we all know. And we have a part to play if we're going to protect ourselves from that enemy. So what's in our grocery bags today? Well, some of us are familiar with a couple of things that might be a little bit amiss in our grocery bags when we check out at the grocery store. But how many of you are aware that nanotechnology is now being employed in the food supply? How many of you know what nanotechnology is? Nanotechnology is basically a method of engineering things at a molecular level. It's like taking a water molecule, for example, that has a hydrogen atom or two hydrogen atoms and an oxygen atom in the center of it, and rearranging those atoms so that it gives a water molecule different properties. Now, I'm not saying water is what they're working with, I'm just using this as an example. But when scientists apply this technology to things like carbon and silver and many other different elements, they've been able to come up with compounds that are relatively simple compounds but have very different behaviors than what those compounds would normally have. And many of these things are being employed in packaging in the food industry today for food preservation. There are materials that are going into the plastics of meat wrappers, for example, that prevent the meat from turning brown so that that steak can sit there on the grocer's shelf for weeks at a time and still be red, and you'll have no visual clue or cue as to the age of that product. How many of these things are in our food system? We don't really know. My guess is that in the packaged food industry, they're quite prevalent today. The reality is that much of this information is considered confidential business information, and there are no government regulations on nanotechnology in our food supply at all. Not one. This is pretty alarming to me. And from my understanding of what's been going on in some of the other aspects of agriculture, I recognize that this is not an accident that we don't know about these things. Now, I think most of us are aware that pesticides are a problem with foods, thanks to Rachel Carson, who wrote a book back in 1962 called Silent Spring. We have an awareness for the fact that, wow, things that kill bugs and weeds and fungi could be a bad thing if I ate that. So we're all a little bit wary of those things. Our radar is up, so to speak, when it comes to pesticides. What most people don't realize today is our food is more contaminated today than it was 30 years ago with pesticides, because a lot of lip service is paid to pesticide laws and legislation that has limits and standards for pesticides, but the reality of the circumstance is that so few of those are enforced that we have more of a pesticide load in our food supply today than we did 30 years ago. Part of the reason for that is because of all that imported food. Less than 1% of all the food that comes into this country from overseas is ever inspected. And by inspection, what I'm talking about is the inspector opening the back of the shipping container and verifying that that shipment of bananas actually is bananas. That's considered an inspection. They look for pests that might be a problem to other American agriculturalists, but they're not looking for pesticide residues. Less than 1% of that 1% that they inspect is actually analyzed for pesticide residues, and in most cases, the vast majority of cases, the levels exceed legal limits and that container is rejected. But that container is only one container out of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of containers that are being imported. And the importer or the exporter is willing to take that risk to get that product into the country, knowing that so few eyes are looking for problems there. How many of you know what a GMO is? That's good. When I first started asking this question almost a decade ago, very few hands went up. But a GMO is a genetically modified organism. This is an entirely new construct of food that is dominantly in our food supply today. And we're going to spend a little time tomorrow speaking specifically about this and some of the risks that it presents to us. But genetically modified organisms are not only of a concern to me because they present a health risk, they are also a concern to me because they violate the Lord's blueprint for how crops are to reproduce. It's a direct violation of Genesis chapter 1, verses 11 and 12. And I have a very strong spiritual conviction that we should avoid these things, as well as a conviction based on health and personal property rights issues that the press is covering. How many of you know what this last little thing is over here, this little symbol over here? Anybody recognize that? You're probably not familiar with it because for the most part, that's a symbol that was used on meat products for a period of time. You won't see it on food anymore, but that symbol is called the radura. And that symbol was applied to meat products specifically that had been treated with irradiation to lessen the potential for contamination from things like E. coli and salmonella. What most Americans don't realize today is that irradiation is also being used on fresh fruits and produce. All of us have been hearing about the contamination issues of the food supply. A few years ago, it was spinach. Year before last, it was tomatoes and jalapeno peppers. Just last week, it was bean sprouts in Germany. All of these issues have the food industry clamoring to be allowed to irradiate all of our fresh fruits and vegetables to prevent the spread of these diseases or these pathogens, which, by the way, don't normally inhabit produce. The consequence of irradiation is that, again, we are depleting the nutritional value of food. The way irradiation works is that it breaks apart the DNA in the bacteria, but it also breaks apart the DNA in the plant cell itself. And although some government studies have indicated that levels of things like carbohydrate and protein remain pretty much the same, very little research has been done to look at what happens to vitamins and to some of the complex phytochemicals in our food when it's exposed to these levels of irradiation. Pesticides are a big issue in food today because the dominant avenue of attack for pesticides on the human body is our nervous system. Pesticides are neurotoxic. They go after our endocrine system, controlling hormones in the body. This is why so many cancers are associated with pesticides. And the dominant place that pesticides impact the human body is the frontal lobe of our brain. Now, if I was an enemy of God's people and I wanted to disrupt their capacity for spiritual discernment necessary for the coming trials that we have at the end of time, wouldn't that be a nifty tool? If I can scramble our thinking and prevent our capacity to discern those spiritual issues that are so important, that would be a very useful tool, wouldn't it? And it's all around us. It's all around us. Today, America's food supply is dominantly contaminated with pesticides. 98% of all the food sold in America is contaminated with pesticides. And when I say contaminated, I mean that there are levels of pesticides that exceed government safety standards. Now, how does this happen? It happens, again, because much of our food is imported today, and so little of it is inspected. Most of us, when we think about the risks from pesticides, think about insecticides, things that kill insects. But the pesticides that are dominantly in our food supply today are herbicides and fungicides, which are no less dangerous to our frontal lobe because they are basically built from the same blueprints and building blocks, if you will, of the pesticide molecules that are used in insecticides. It's a very similar family of chemistry. Foreign food products, again, are rarely tested for residues. The latest battlefront that we face is with this issue of food contamination. E. coli 0157H7 is popping up everywhere. This is a particular strain of E. coli that was not known prior to 1982. It was first identified in cattle feedlots and confined animal feeding operations. It's been determined that it's a consequence of feeding corn to cattle. Cattle are intended to eat grass, not corn, but we want to fatten them faster. When we fatten them up with corn, we alter the pH in their gut system, and this particular strain of E. coli mutated and proliferates in that acidic gut environment. But we're finding this organism now in all kinds of fresh produce items, which doesn't make sense at all to me. Nevertheless, it's there. So as a consequence of this, we have a tremendous pressure worldwide now through Codex Alimentarius and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and some other large multinational corporations to impose irradiation on our food supply. And to give you an idea of what we're talking about here, the irradiation that's used on chicken, for example, is about 7 million times more irradiation than in a chest x-ray. Now, if you went to your doctor and wanted to go in for a chest x-ray every week for a month, what do you think he'd tell you? He'd say, no, I wouldn't suggest that. There's some health hazards associated with that, right? We don't want to be blasting ourselves with x-rays all the time. But yet, we're willing to take our food and expose it to a level 7 million times what would be found in that chest x-ray. This is already playing out in our food supply. Almonds are one of my favorite foods. I grew up in almond country. The little community that I grew up in was surrounded with about 60,000 acres of almonds. My first jobs in agriculture were working in almond orchards. But on September 1st of 2007, the USDA imposed a marketing order saying that all raw almonds had to be treated with steam heat propylene oxide, which is a chemical sterilizing agent, or irradiation in order to be sold. This was as a consequence of four cases of salmonella that were traced to raw almonds. Now, this is a serious problem to me because when we sterilize an almond, we're preventing it from sprouting. We're killing the seed, basically. And almonds, to me, are a major source of protein in my diet, not to mention the fact that they're a very healthful nut. But why in the world would we require the sterilization of all of the raw nuts, the raw almonds that are sold in this country based on four cases of salmonella? It doesn't make sense to me. I'm going to give you some of my ideas a little bit later on this week as to why I think this is happening. But nevertheless, this is the case. If you're the irony of this particular circumstance is they can still label these almonds as raw. When you go into Whole Foods and you buy raw almonds, they've had one of these three treatments, but you're not informed about it. Another issue facing us in agriculture today that has me concerned as a small market farmer is what has come to be called the Food Safety Modernization Act. Some of you probably saw some information flying around on the internet about this last winter. This bill, S-510, was signed into law on January 4th by President Obama. This particular bill gives authority for the first time to the Food and Drug Administration to essentially govern what goes on a small farm and to control safety aspects of how food is produced. And this pertains to anybody that is growing food that moves off their property, whether they're selling it or giving it away or donating it to a food pantry, it doesn't matter. If food leaves my property and is not consumed on my property, I am subject to these regulations. Now, there was an amendment that helped to get this bill passed called the Tester Amendment, which basically exempted small farms. And that's how the press promoted this, was that Senator John Tester from Montana attached this amendment that exempted small farms, but the only exemption is from the licensing fee of $1,000 per year. Small farms still have to comply with all of the regulation. And this regulation is very onerous and is going to make it very difficult for small growers to compete and to grow. In fact, if you are a small-scale business and you're doing less than $500,000 per year of sales, to go beyond that $500,000 a year, now that sounds like a lot of money to most of us, but in terms of an agricultural enterprise or business, that's not a whole lot of money. In order to break that threshold of $500,000, it's almost going to be impossible under these new regulations. So this is forcing small growers to stay small, basically. This legislation was written by a lobbyist who is married to it was written by a congresswoman that was married to a lobbyist for Monsanto Corporation. And there's no question in my mind that part of the direction of this bill is to try to put a little bit of a lid on some of this local food industry that is growing wildly around the country right now. They don't want their profit margins being bitten into, and we're seeing some of that happen. Breaking the species barrier. New developments in agriculture over the course of the last decade or so has been this issue of the genetic engineering of our food supply. This is basically taking a cell from a plant, such as a corn plant, and using tissue culture methods, which allow us to develop an entire plant from one single cell. And by blasting the nucleus of that cell with a genetic cassette from some other life form, whether it's a virus, a bacteria, a fish, or an animal, or another plant, we can insert DNA now from an entirely different species. This is something that cannot occur in nature. It can only occur in a laboratory. And we can produce a crop that has certain characteristics. The global area of biotech crops has grown dramatically. This is an old slide here from 2005 that shows that when these were first introduced in 1996 and 97, we had essentially 0 acres of biotech crops. In 2005, we had reached about 240 million acres. This year, we have surpassed 360 million acres of these biotech crops that are being grown. Biotech crops are the only pollution that grows. Once you plant a biotech or genetically modified crop outdoors in the environment, all of that genetic information is carried in the pollen of those plants, and it spreads, and it cannot be recalled. So once we turn this genie loose out of its bottle, we're never going to get it back. Today in America, these are the lists of foods that are acceptable for human consumption, that have been approved for human consumption, that contain genetically modified varieties. And I want you to pay particular attention to these last three items right here, because if you're buying packaged products, it's very likely that some of those packaged products contain yeast enzymes or bacteria that are genetically modified. The example that I like to give is cranberry juice. We don't see cranberries anywhere on the list here, but one of my favorite summertime drinks after a long hot day on the farm is a little bit of water with a little bit of cranberry juice in it and some ice to cool off at the end of the day. Well, that cranberry juice that I use very likely contains a clarifying agent made from enzymes that are genetically modified. These things are so pervasive in our food supply today that it's estimated that about 80% of all packaged foods from our grocery stores contain some genetically modified constituent. In fact, I bought a loaf of bread at a Food Lion store over in Virginia about 2 years ago, and I looked at the ingredients on that loaf of bread, and I did some research, and I discovered that in this loaf of 100% whole wheat bread, there were 11 different genetically modified ingredients, none of which were wheat. We have relinquished control over our food supply to a handful of companies. And these six companies that you see on the screen here dominantly control what's on your dinner table today. These six companies control about 80% of all of the commercial seed varieties that are grown in the world today, not just in America, but in the world. One of the reasons that we know so little about some of the hazards of genetically modified foods is because it's not getting any press in the United States. Our policy was developed essentially by the industry itself. Under the first Bush administration, Vice President Dan Quayle was put in charge of developing a new regulatory scheme for dealing with biotech crops. And his regulatory scheme basically was what the industry suggested to him, and that was that we call genetically modified crops basically substantially equivalent to their conventionally bred counterparts. If we have corn, for example, that has a genetically modified ingredient in it or a genetically modified characteristic to it, and it looks like corn and it cooks like corn and it grows like corn, we're just going to consider that corn. And since we've been growing corn for generations, it's generally regarded as safe, and we don't need to regulate it. And that's the policy that's in place to this day in the United States. Because of that policy, we have no labeling on genetically modified foods. We don't know what's genetically modified and what isn't. Because of that policy, there are no ongoing safety studies of genetically modified foods. There has not been one single human feeding study of a genetically modified food. We simply don't know. We also know that the industry is working to genetically modified crops for the production of pharmaceutical and industrial compounds. Some of you may recall a couple of years ago when a crop of corn was quarantined in Texas because it contained a pig vaccine. It showed up where it wasn't supposed to show up, and fortunately they caught that particular example, but there are literally thousands of tests going on around the country today where various different crops are being grown for purposes other than food. And this has a huge implication because of the potential for something that we call pollen drift. Remember, if we release these things into the environment, we're not getting them back. They can go out there and cross-pollinate with traditional varieties, and indeed have. The United States Department of Agriculture tells us that a 300-foot buffer strip around a genetically modified crop is sufficient to prevent outcrossing. I think that this gives us a pretty good example as to why that doesn't make any sense. We also have plants that have been modified with human genes. Corn, rice, apples, and tobacco, probably many more that we know very little about, have been modified with human genes for pharmaceutical purposes. Animals have been modified with human genes. Goats, pigs, cattle, chickens, mice, sheep. There's a flock of, there are pigs up at Purdue University right now that contain human genes, and a lot of research is being done there on developing transplant organs from these particular pigs that have human genes in them, with the concept being that they will be less likely to be rejected. A lot of other things are being undertaken as well that are classified as confidential business information. We know very little about that. To give you an idea of the scope of this technology, up until about a year and a half ago, they were keeping numbers on this. As of today, they've stopped doing this, so I'm not exactly sure what the accurate number is for today's date. But on March 9th, 2009, these were the numbers of different tests that were being done with genetically modified foods around the country. Almost 15,300 open-air field tests. 1,557 different crops have been released to growers. That means no further regulation at that point. Once these things are released to growers here, there is no further follow-up regulation. It's considered just like any other crop. Now, there were only, there weren't 1,500 different items on that list of foods that I showed you that are genetically modified, but the reason there are so many here is because many of these are corn and soy and cotton varieties and so forth. Many different genetic constructs of the same crop. There's an article I ran across in 2006 that, as a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, really excited me. It was an article called DNA is Not Destiny. And this was an article printed in Discover magazine. It was written by a man named Ethan Waters, and it described the research of a man named Dr. Randy Jertle. And Dr. Jertle was doing research with mice and discovered that a particular strain of mouse called an agouti mouse, which was kind of yellowish in color, tended to be obese, and had a high susceptibility to cancer, if he changed the diet of a pregnant mouse, the offspring of that mouse would be normal. Through a lifestyle change of the mother, the offspring of the mouse were normal. They were normal in color, normal in weight, and they didn't have the propensity for cancer. And not only did that influence extend to that first generation, but it extended to the third and fourth generation. This caught my attention because I believe in something called righteousness by faith. And what we have here, folks, is physical evidence for that righteousness by faith. We can see now a mechanism by which this works. But what this also points out is that there are things going on in the reproduction of life that we know very little about. Biotechnology is based on the premise of taking one gene, like a Lego, and snapping it into a position on a chromosome and getting a desired result. And what we know now is that that is an entirely poor hypothesis that does not take into consideration many of the things that science has recently discovered about what governs reproduction. Denise Caruso, who wrote a book entitled Intervention a few years ago about the risks of genetic engineering, wrote an article for the New York Times called A Challenge to Gene Theory, where she basically presents this case to the press and says, look, our whole foundation for this science of genetically modifying foods is based on flawed science. And no one has refuted this yet to this point. Now, if you listen to the Gates Foundation or you listen to the Monsanto advertising or the advertising of some of the other companies engaged in this technology, what you're going to hear is that, well, you know, we've got this problem. We've got a burgeoning world population. Right now, we've got 800 million to a billion people starving to death every year. We've got to grow more food, and biotech is the way to do that. Well, in some ways, this violates some of their own research. Back in 2001, the Food and Agriculture Organization undertook a study to try to determine what the capacity of the earth was to produce food. And they examined the resources in 2001 in terms of land, water, technology, seeds, and how food was produced around the planet. And they came up with a figure of 600 billion people could be fed with the current technology of 2001. That means not adding another acre into production. That means not inventing any new method for technologically improving production. That was just based on the production capacity in 2001. So why is it that we have so many hungry people in the world today? It's not because the Lord is not faithful in providing us with the means to produce food. It's because of economic, political, and social oppression. It's people's access to food that is lacking, not the food itself. 40% of the American corn crop this year is going to be put in our gas tanks while we have a billion people in the world starving to death. Does that make sense to you? I wanted to take some time to show you how this food system works, the food distribution system, but we're out of time today, so I'm going to have to share this with you tomorrow. But I think it's important for us, before we start talking about things that I know that you want to hear later this week, about how to grow better tomatoes or how to enrich your soil, how it is that our food system works today. Because most of us really don't have a clue as to how that artichoke gets from Castroville, California, to the shelf of a Walmart store in Lexington, or how our broccoli moves from northern Mexico into the grocery store in our local community, how much time is involved, and what's involved in doing all of that. But I think it's important that we understand this. My purpose today has been to try to influence you about the importance of what we have been counseled about for over 100 years. And that is that we need to take agriculture seriously. And I say this because being someone that was educated in agriculture before I became a Seventh-day Adventist, I have a deep appreciation for the Adventist message on agriculture. And when I look at what opportunities we have before us today, it makes my heart break to realize that 100 years ago, Ellen White was telling us to pay specific attention to agriculture when we had, at that time, an agrarian society. Unfortunately, we've slipped away from that. And with what I know about farming today, it gives me great grief because I know that had we stayed the course, had we applied our talents, our energies, our budgets, our efforts to agriculture, today the world would be beating a path to our door wanting to know what we knew. We would have varieties of food that were separate and apart from the world, not only with healthful properties, but with capacity for healing. We don't have that today. So we're relying on evangelism and methods of outreach that, yes, have some degree of success, but I wonder how much more successful we could be if we took this message seriously. I'm out of time. If you would, bow your heads with me for a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we've had opportunity this afternoon to look into some of the issues that we're challenged with at this time in Earth's history. And Father, we recognize that we have become victims, perhaps unawares. But there is a solution to that. You've given us that solution in your instruction through your word, and through your prophet, through your book of nature. And my prayer, Father, as we depart here, is that we will take these things to heart. And as we have opportunity this week to discuss these things more, please enlighten us as to what your will is for us specifically in this regard. I ask in Jesus' name, amen.